Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 119, recorded Sunday, December 20th, 2015. This is the podcast giving the voice to the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: digital security on the road and U.S. airports getting better. Well, hey, coming to you again from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, cranking out one last episode to keep you occupied while you navigate the holiday security lines while trying to get to or perhaps away from family. Myself, I'm settling in for the Christmas break after doing a day trip on Friday to Philadelphia. I'm divorcing myself. I'm quitting O'Hare until January. No, I haven't done any really remarkable travel since the last episode, just trips to Cleveland, Vegas, and Boston. Now, when I was flying out of Vegas last week back here to Chicago, I hit the American Express Centurion Lounge for a couple of conference calls before I got on the plane back. It's free entry with a Amex Platinum card, and it's so far and beyond any of the Admirals Clubs or Sky Clubs or United Clubs. You know, it's not quite as hip. It's a bit more buttoned down than, say, Virgin Atlantic's Upper Lounge in Heathrow. But I'll tell you, you know, for comfort, the free buffet, the open bar, it is as good as any sort of European-style business class air lounge. It's really highly recommended. If you end up with that, if you end up with a platinum card for business, check it out. Go find them. I just wish there were more of them. Now, when I'm flying into Boston, I'm actually, you know, heading probably 45 minutes west of Boston, close to Worcester. Of course, it's not spelled Worcester, but as I have been trained by a good college friend of mine, it's Worcester. So, I mean, that ends up being a 45-minute drive out I-90 when I land at, say, 9 or 10 in the morning. But I tell you, when I land at 5 in the evening into Logan, it's an entirely different matter. I touch down at Logan, flip the phone out of airplane mode, and immediately open Waze. I mean, how bad is the traffic? How about an hour and 45-minute drive? Yeah, so, you know, not looking forward to a parking lot. I threaded my way one time over to, kind of the first time this happened, I threaded my way over to Chelsea, which meant I didn't have to go through any tunnels or anything. I was able to kind of wind around. I found a great little microbrewery complete with real live Boston Irish people. And I got to sample one, two, maybe four of their beers. Then I walked up a couple of blocks to a Central American joint underneath a highway overpass, and I had just a great plate of food for less than $10. And by that time, the traffic had cleared. I'll tell you, I've now spent a couple of dinner times wandering around the neighborhoods near Logan, you know, Charlestown, the Seaport District, and then, as I just said, Chelsea, waiting for Waze to tell me that I-90's traffic tantrum has subsided. But probably the biggest travel event this week wasn't mine, but my daughter's. It was her first solo flight, returning from her first semester at University of St. Andrews, flying Aer Lingus from Edinburgh to Chicago by way of Dublin. I mean, it's a big adjustment in a couple of ways. First, of course, she has to figure out a new airport by herself. She's never been through Dublin before. But I thought a smaller airport like Dublin would be better for her first solo flight than trying to navigate the start of holiday traffic, say, at Heathrow. But she does now have to pay attention to what's going on rather than just sort of following in my slipstream. You know, the second adjustment, I don't know, it feels a little bit more like a first world problem. She's now flying as a plain old passenger, a villager, rather than tagging along with me through the gold or platinum baggage check lines and pre-boarding. It's a tough come down, but I did soften the blow a little bit. I did pay her global entry fee as a going away gift. So following up, you know, I didn't get much feedback on the last episode, though Ian Morgan swung by the Facebook page, adding some supporting British Airways' stricter carry-on policy that we covered a couple of episodes back. Ian writes, you know, I just listened to your October episode, picked up your post about British Airways hand luggage. They have just changed their policy on this to clamp down. I agree it's frustrating, especially in a lightly loaded wide-body aircraft. However, as a regular BA traveler, I have lost count of the number of times BA flights have been delayed whilst cabin crew offload hand luggage, especially since BA introduced their hand baggage only fare. Now, before the change, I never saw BA use those size gauges. These days, they use them much more frequently. It's a part of the steady decline of BA from a full-service airline to a low-cost carrier. Just be grateful that you got a 767 instead of an A321 with the new Space Saver seats with a 29-inch seat pitch. Well, Ian, thanks very much for that. I tell you, I really think you nailed it. The descent of full-service carriers into the low-cost, low-service ring of travel hell created by Ryanair and Spirit Airlines. I've talked about this before. A frequent traveler can't fathom why someone would subject themselves to the hassles that Ryan and Spirit travelers endure. A recent Crane Chicago article about Spirit said just over half, 58% of their flights into O'Hare arrived on time in the first 9 months of 2015. Now, I fly at least 3 weeks out of every four. And, you know, American Airlines' 79% on-time percentage into O'Hare is only just acceptable. I mean, I think I would go completely postal at 58%. But yet, Spirit is now the third largest airline at O'Hare after United and American. I mean, working out of just two shared gates, they've got more flights than Delta. But, you know, but then as I was just wondering and just stunned about these facts, I remembered some comments that were made by the president of American Airlines back like in October. It was during a analyst's call right around the time that American was doing that final merger of the reservation systems with U.S. Air, and everybody was just waiting for all hell to break loose, kind of similar to what happened with United and Continental. Well, the president said during the comments, he said that half of American's revenue last year came from the 87% of its customers that only flew them once. So, you know, 50% of American's revenue came from passengers, you know, in their interpretation, that see air travel as just a commodity and are looking for the lowest cost carriage between two points. And so for 50% of the revenue, American isn't competing against United or Delta. They're competing with Spirit. I think that goes for all the airlines, at least all the U.S. airlines. I mean, it explains Delta's, you know, Spirit-like basic economy offering and the expectation throughout the industry that American and United are going to follow in 2016. And, you know, I kind of assume that BA's hand baggage fees that Ian mentions, you know, they're just right along with that, you know, with that same program, except instead of Spirit, they're competing with Ryan and EasyJet. You know, the challenge, though, is how do you compete for the 87% of your passengers that are buying a commodity while you also serve the remaining 13% of your passengers who are contributing the other 50% of your revenue and value the little things like a seat that reclines a bit and a flight that arrives on time? And how do you satisfy that while both of these constituents are in the same plane? I mean, Spirit doesn't have that problem because they never get that 13% of people like myself who care about service. But BA, American, Delta, United, they've got the tougher problem. So back to my daughter's flight that I mentioned in the earlier segment. So connecting through Dublin Airport, she ended up clearing U.S. Immigration and Customs there in Ireland and then just popped out at the one domestic baggage carousel in O'Hare's Terminal 5, still in the international terminal, but it was a domestic baggage carousel. So she did not, obviously, didn't have to go through Immigration and Customs when she hit O'Hare. I mean, it's kind of similar to what they've been doing at Toronto's Pearson Airport since, I don't know, forever. I mean, at least the 90s when I was flying through there weekly. You know, but there, American's Toronto to O'Hare flight would land at, you know, at Terminal 3, one of the domestic terminals, just like, say, a flight from Buffalo. And then you'd make your connection or walk out to the cab line. I mean, handy for the regular traveler, but if you've dropped the $100 global entry fee, immigration lines at, say, O'Hare really aren't any worse than they would be in Toronto or Dublin. You know, indeed, my daughter was bummed that she went through that the U.S. pre-clearance so soon, because she said the food and the shopping choices on the U.S. side of pre-clearance were a hell of a lot thinner than on the Irish side. And I think that's going to be a problem if the TSA follows through on their announced expansion of pre-clearance from what today is mostly sort of Canadian, Irish, and Caribbean airports to expanding it to 10 much larger airports, including Tokyo Narita, Amsterdam Schiphol, Madrid, London Heathrow. I mean, if you're flying U.S. carriers out of European airports, I mean, you're already being put into sort of a de facto American ghetto anyhow. I mean, you're typically flying out of the most remote gates with the longest walks from security in the airport lounges and with the fewest food and shopping amenities, if you've got any at all. Now, sort of walling it off, walling that sort of de facto ghetto off to create a secured facility to support pre-clearance just really, you know, formalizes it and walls you in. The Department of Homeland Security, the secretary for DHS, calls it a win-win for travelers. I don't know. I think it's just squeezing the balloon, making wait time go down in the U.S., but making it go up in places like Narita and Heathrow. And I mean, you know, it's one thing to miss a connection in O'Hare due to immigration delays. Odds are there's another flight you can catch within a couple of hours. I mean, it's a whole nother thing if you miss that once-a-day flight home from, say, Amsterdam. And on a brighter note, thanks to El Nino, and I got to tell you, I got a man crush on El Nino. It's been a warm start to the winter, at least in North America it has. But soon enough, the temps are going to drop and the winter coats are going to start competing with carry-ons for overhead bin space. Now, you know, last winter, which was a hell of a lot colder, while deplaning, and I don't know, I still have a problem with that verb construction, deplaning. It feels like, you know, Fantasy Island with Hervé, you know, the short guy talking about deplane. Yeah, I don't know. Anyhow, while I was deplaning, whatever the hell that is, someone handed me my black overcoat. It was wedged in front of, you know, his suitcase. And I threw it over my arm as I stepped out into the aisle, grabbed my carry-on, and hoofed it out of the plane, sort of power walking toward the cab line. I mean, it wasn't until I stepped outside that I stopped to put my coat on and found out it wasn't my coat. I mean, I guess I should have checked it. I know I should have checked it when it was handed to me. But, you know, I didn't want to be that guy who stops in the aisle to put his jacket on. So now I got somebody else's jacket. I go over to Lost and Found. The clerk called the gate where the guy with my coat was standing. And he's trying to find his coat. And so we really got lucky. It took us, I don't know, about 10 minutes to kind of sort it all out. He came down to Lost and Found. We swapped coats. We have a little bit of a chuckle. I mean, if it had been warmer out like this week, I might not have put my coat on at all and have gotten home, you know, would have ended up getting all the way home before I noticed the switch. You know, black bags, black coats. Look, I love that black hides a lot of sins, scuffs, dirts, extra pounds. But, you know, you're not always loving that ubiquity at the airport. I mean, you know, I tell you, as you guys are flying next two holiday weeks, keep your eyes on your stuff in these crowds. You don't want Lost to be the new black. Hey, and if you have any thoughts, questions, a story, comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email, as always, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock. You can post your thoughts on the Facebook page, the Travel Commons Facebook page, or always, as it's still there, you can post a comment on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is digital security on the road. Digital security, cybersecurity. I tell you, I don't know about you, but I've kind of hit security breach fatigue. I mean, this past Thursday, yet another company announced a credit card breach. This time it's Landry's, the guys who run Bubba Gump's and Morton's Steakhouse and another 15 or so restaurant brands. You know, the funny thing is I didn't even see this in the news. I just picked it up on the web because I follow some security blogs. I mean, again, back to this sort of, you know, security breach fatigue. It's just a given anymore. But, you know, it doesn't even make the news. Now, in this case for Landry's, I mean, I don't frequent Landry's brands all that much. So, you know, I'm hoping that this breach doesn't mean I'm going to have to replace one of my credit cards again and sort of go through the whole sort of goat rodeo of changing account numbers for all my auto bills. But like I was saying, I mean, it kind of does reinforce just, you know, another drumbeat that, you know, the feeling that cybersecurity, you know, and put air quotes around that is more, you know, more a matter of when than if. But even if it is a matter of when, I'd still like to postpone the when as long as possible. And traveling, and certainly during the holidays, there's a lot of opportunity to bring on the when if you're not, you know, just a bit thoughtful. And with this, though, and to be realistic, let's face it, I mean, there's a balance between inconvenience, the cost of being more digitally secure, and the probability of being breached. I don't know if I can say that without having to flag this episode explicit in iTunes. But again, if you're not feeling that trade-off, if it's too much of a hassle, you're just not going to do it. So what is that balance point? I mean, you know, I mean, you could always go old school, like sort of 10 years ago when there's damn little public Wi-Fi, there were no iPhones, and there was, you know, sort of nothing to keep us entertained as we shuffled through the TSA lines other than sort of trading snarky remarks with the other line sufferers. I mean, you could go the burner route, you know, using disposable phones and a temporary PC, which is what many business travelers to China still do. I mean, I did the trips I made over there, you know, doing a complete wipe of the phone and the PC before and after the visit, because you just expect to get hacked no matter what. And there's just not enough antivirus or other, you know, safety precautions to, you know, that are going to save you from it. But if you're going from, say, you know, San Francisco to Boston to see your family, you know, doing full wipes of all your electronics seems a bit overkill. Definitely not balancing that cost-benefit trade-off. I mean, I got to tell you, I'm pretty lazy about this stuff, but there are a few precautions I take. First, I never do any financial stuff over public Wi-Fi. No checking my bank account or checking credit card activity over an airport or a Starbucks Wi-Fi or actually a hotel network at all, whether Wi-Fi or jacked into the Ethernet port. I mean, even if the URL is showing HTTPS, right, the S meaning an encrypted connection, I don't know, there's just too many ways that those networks or websites can be misconfigured. Now, some folks will tell you to use a VPN, a virtual private network, which gives you a whole nother encryption layer on top of that. And I used one in China, but I, you know, again, hassle factor, it's just a bit too much in the US to start up the PC, to log into a Wi-Fi, and then to fire up the VPN, and then to do 3 minutes of something, right? I mean, I've spent more time setting up the session than I did checking whatever I wanted to check. So instead, for me, if I've got to do some banking, I'll actually use my iPhone over the mobile carrier network, you know, AT&T in the US, Orange when I was in Spain, EE when I was last in the UK. Look, I know it's not perfect, but by not traversing the public Wi-Fi network, I think it, what the cybersecurity guys say, I think it reduces the attack surface at what is considered to be one of the more vulnerable points. I very, very rarely use those hotel PCs that they've got set up in lobbies or concierge lounges for sort of general public use. I mean, on one hand, I mean, if I've got a smartphone or a tablet or a PC, why do I need a public PC that's, let's face it, open to anybody who wants to load up a keylogger that'll capture anything you type, including logins and passwords? I mean, so if I, for some weird reason, need to use one of these hotel PCs, I never log into anything. I never log into it. Maybe what I do is maybe I'm just like searching for a restaurant, but that's absolutely it. I think I also wash my hands off with like sanitizer afterwards. Now, I always make sure that I've configured my phone and PC email clients to use encrypted communications between the servers, you know, using IMAP and SMTP over SSL. Now, there you go. Now we're talking security, because in that last sentence, I used more acronyms than words. I do that for my, connecting to my own mail servers. I mean, Gmail does it automatically for you, but I don't encrypt the message itself, sort of no PGP or signed MIME. I mean, there's nothing in my emails that is, so confidential that it makes me want to go through the hassle of exchanging public keys with the recipient. I gotta tell you, my life is not that interesting. I recently, though, turned on two-factor authentication for every service that offers it. So Gmail, any of my financial accounts that offer it, even Dropbox. And this is another one I resisted it for a long time. Again, I thought it was kind of more hassle than it was worth. But then I started getting odd, password reset email requests that I didn't request. And I started seeing more and more of those. And I was like, okay, now the hassle seemed to be worth it. Now, I go back and forth on using smartphone or printed boarding passes. Now, the smartphone boarding passes are quicker. I mean, you can get them while you're in the cab or the train on the way to the airport, rather than having to, go and queue up for a kiosk. But I found more than a few times, I've talked about this on past episodes, where my boarding pass on my smartphone disappears from the app during some extended flight delay. And so now suddenly when you got to reboard, I got no boarding, I have no boarding pass. And now I got to go, hey, look, don't give my seat away. I mean, printed boarding passes don't disappear. And they're certainly easier to scan at the gate, especially when you're juggling sort of a backpack, a hot coffee, and a winter coat. But there's recently been a bit of a stir about the amount of personal information somebody could pull out of the barcodes on the printed boarding pass. I don't know, maybe I'm not paranoid enough, but that one feels sort of a bit of a stretch. So I end up doing whatever is the most convenient, usually the smartphone route. But when I do print a boarding pass, I don't know, I just tend to keep it in my jacket pocket rather than stuffing it in the seat pocket, seat back in front of me. I tend to sort of keep it on me. And then throw it away when I get home or, get to the hotel, and maybe rip it up into a couple of pieces. I don't know, just to be sure. So the second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is, are U.S. airports getting better? While I poked a bit at London Heathrow a few episodes back, it's an article of faith among international travelers that North American airports just pale in comparison to airports in Asia-Pac. I mean, anybody flying from Beijing or Singapore to LAX needs a light sedative to cushion the reentry shock. And also, North American airports pretty much trail behind most of the European airports, too. But J.D. Power, in their airport satisfaction survey that they released last week, said that things are getting better. I mean, not hugely better, sort of a 5 to 8% increase in kind of their satisfaction scoring. But I got to tell you, for the frequent traveler, any improvement is good news. Now, Power rated large and medium-sized North American airports, about 60 U.S. airports, and then Toronto Pearson, Calgary, Montreal, and Vancouver. They surveyed travelers around six attributes of their airport experience. In order of importance, they are kind of the state of the airport facilities themselves, just how decent they are, how easy it is to get to the airport, security, baggage claim, the check-in experience, and available food and shopping. Now, a frequent traveler might reshuffle the order, maybe drop baggage claim and check-in experience to the bottom because, we rarely check a bag. But, overall, I think it's a good list. And I think some of Power's conclusions line up with some of the things I'm seeing on the road, like improvement in terminal facilities. I mean, in the last episode, I gave United a shout-out for the upgrade of their gate space in Boston Logan. I really think it's really nice. And then I continue to tell anybody that I talk to that I think San Francisco, SFO, what they did with that complete gut and rebuild of Terminal 2, I mean, it did take them forever, but the results are really excellent. And I tell you, I think they stand up. I think that terminal, that Terminal 2, stands up to any airport in Asia or Europe. Europe. The rest of SFO, not so great. But Terminal 2, that's where American and Virgin America fly in. That's a great place. You know, Power found, I think, what's a pretty logical connection, as you would guess, between customer satisfaction and the amount of time you spend in lines. And as I said earlier, I rarely deal with check-in lines, but I think the TSA's rollout of PreCheck has provided a quantum-level improvement in the security experience. We've talked about this. Though, I'll tell you, recently, it feels like that popularity is on the verge of overwhelming PreCheck and having that experience slide back a little bit. I've been noticing some, you know, especially places like O'Hare, some real long morning lines. And so it feels like they got to kind of get on top of that and rejuggle it. And then even for the people in the regular lines, I tell you, I've seen the TSA folks, again, mostly at O'Hare, working hard to rebalance those lines. So I think it was bad. I think it's getting a little bit better, although flying in the holiday season, that's going to be challenging. Now, Power split their ratings between large and medium airports. Now, their winning large airport is Portland, Oregon, PDX. Now, I've done a bit of flying in and out of Portland, and while I wouldn't have unprompted chosen it as the top large airport, you know, I really don't argue with their conclusion. I mean, it's a nice facility. It's got easy mass transit, you know, which is a travel commons fixation, you know, easy mass transit via that MAX light rail. I mean, I disagree with its top marks for security check, but I tell you, how many other airports can you buy a growler of craft beer to go? I mean, just for that alone, it ought to get top marks. Now, the bottom four, these I could have ticked off on my hand without missing a beat. LaGuardia, Newark, LAX, and O'Hare. I mean, old terminals, awkward layouts, leaking roofs, lousy food. I mean, it is interesting, though, that they're also the major airports for the U.S.'s three largest cities. Now, the medium airport winner was a tie between Dallas's Love Field, their downtown airport, and Fort Myers Southwest Florida Airport. This one, I don't know. I mean, I've used both of these airports a lot. Love has gone through a good-sized facelift, and I haven't been through it since they finished, so I may be working off of some out-of-date impressions. But even though it's close to downtown, it's a real pain to get to. Now, Fort Myers is easy to get to, and I absolutely love the short walk from the terminal across the street to the rental car facility. But the security screening there can back way up, especially during snowbird season, and the food choice isn't that great. I mean, I got to tell you, from my personal experience, I'd give top marks to Nashville in that medium category. I mean, how can you go wrong with live music, good live music, as you're walking down the terminal? Now, Power's most obvious finding was that dissatisfied customers are very vocal. So Power says that those who rate overall satisfaction at the bottom of the scale, one on a 10-point scale, make an average of 13 negative comments about their experience. And anyone who follows me on Twitter knows how true that is. Okay, that's it. That is the end of Travel Commons Podcast number 119. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes, as always, for music links. You can find Travel Commons on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes. So when you get that new electronic device over the holidays, make sure you download that podcast application, whatever you choose, and subscribe to Travel Commons. You know, take your wife or your kids, subscribe them to Travel Commons. Let's spread the love. And as always, if you've got a story, a thought, a comment, a gripe, the voice of the traveler, send him along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or to M. Peacock on Twitter. Write him on the Travel Commons page on Facebook, or post him at the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on Facebook or on the website. I really appreciate it. Hey, have a safe holiday, safe Christmas travels. Have a great holiday, and look forward to talking to you in the new year. Take care. Travel safe. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.